Welcome to the DJE Podcast, where you will learn about real estate investing from real life examples. Here's your host, Devin Elder.
Okay, guys, welcome to the show. As always, if you have multifamily questions that I or my team can answer, you can connect with us at djetexas.com, and there's a way to download a free resource and set up a 15-minute call with us. Okay, today my guest on the show is Mr. Lane Bean. He's a retired USAF F-16 pilot with a 15-year side hustle, single-family investor that converted to multifamily syndication. His goal is to help others become better millionaires. Without further ado, Mr. Lane Bean, how are you?
I'm good, Devin. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak to your audience today and share a little bit about my knowledge and experience with multifamily real estate.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot to dive in there, but I would love to know a little bit about your background and how you initially came to real estate. Was that something you discovered early on, or what was the genesis of that?
Right. So, I was in the active duty Air Force for almost a decade. And then after I separated from active duty, I transitioned to the Air Force Reserves. I was a full-time Air Force Reserve officer with the aspirations of becoming a commercial airline pilot. And this time frame was about the year 2000. Well, in the fall of 2000 is when we had 9/11 occur, and that essentially terminated a lot of the commercial hiring in the airline industry. And so I had to kind of find something new to do. And I'd always been handy around my own house with making repairs and making improvements. And so there was a single family property in my neighborhood that was abandoned. And so I purchased that just with the aspirations of, let me see if I can do this, because I always had an entrepreneurial spirit and I enjoyed real estate. And so I turned that one single family property and duplicated it many times throughout the early year 2000 until the 2007-2008 financing crisis in single family happened. And it didn't damage my portfolio at all, but it just limited immediately the amount of properties that I was able to purchase because I couldn't get conditional financing on new single family properties.
Right.
And so what I did is I transitioned to multifamily properties and commercial at that point, which was multifamily, duplexes, small apartment buildings, that sort of thing. And that's how I got my start into both real estate, single family, and then a transition to multifamily properties also.
Yeah, that's great. I love it. I've got a soft spot for, you know, deeply distressed single family assets. That's how I got my start as well. A lot of folks have that story. That first property that was abandoned, was it a complete disaster? Was it abandoned for a couple of weeks or years? Were there a family of raccoons living in there? What did it look like?
No, it wasn't too bad. I mean, there was some things that mainly minor updates and repairs and some new carpets, some of the standard things you would see in a, sure, in a relatively, you know, what I would say a fix and flip today. That I don't know if that strategy was really that prevalent back then, but that's kind of what it was. I didn't flip it. I held it for a long time, but it was just a fixer upper, I guess is the best way to say it.
Gotcha. So did you go into it financing it with cash or hard money and then refinance, or what was your approach on that?
Well, at that time, it was, you know, very favorable financing terms. And so I think I actually bought the house. I bought it at $85,000. I'm here in Fort Worth. So the home price is very reasonable. And I was able to buy it secured for almost $500 is all I had into it. So I think that the financing terms were, and the loan to value was just really attractable at that time. And you really can't get that now. Nowadays, but that's what it was in that year.
Yeah, that's great. Well, hey, that's a good deal to take advantage of. So as you go through the single family process, you're renovating a lot of projects over those kind of the early 2000s. Was it a gradual transition to multifamily with the smaller stuff, like you said, or was there some big aha moment where you said, I need to go bigger? What did that look like?
Well, so I basically duplicated that same recipe several times. And so I had about 10 single family homes, and then and all of them were with conventional financing, bank financing, bank notes, and that sort of thing. So in 2007, when the single family financing crisis kind of unwinded there, I couldn't continue to expand or scale up real estate investing because I couldn't get conventional financing anymore for these properties. And so at that point was where I thought, well, I'm going to have to, if I want to continue to grow my real estate business, I'm going to have to use multifamily, or I'm going to have to use a different type of financing, or I'm going to have to consider commercial real estate, which is not based on the same financing requirements. And so that's kind of where, that was kind of the crossroads of where I departed single family investing into multifamily investing.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the market conditions change, the attractiveness of certain areas or asset classes can fluctuate. So you've got to be flexible with that kind of stuff. Now, with your transition to multifamily, Lane, did you immediately start syndicating, meaning raising capital from other investors, or how did, what did that look like for you?
So this is a good lesson learned, Devin. So when you have the single family mentality, you have what I call a, most people start with what I call a DIY mentality, do it yourself yes. mentality. And so when I transitioned to multifamily, I thought, well, I'm just going to be able to DIY it again. I'm going to be able to do it myself. And so even though I didn't, you asked me, did I syndicate or did I sponsor any other investors with me? I had maybe one or two that I was considering, but I still had this mindset that I was going to be able to finance these projects and maybe start with a duplex and then two duplexes and double that by myself. And the point to this, the point that I'm making is when you have a multifamily investments, these are not normally do-it-yourself projects. You have to incorporate a team of professionals to include contractors, to include financing, to include acquisition, to include title. All of these things. And that also includes your team of investors. And so most projects of any scale are not probably something that an individual can take down by themselves. You're probably not going to have that amount of net worth. So did I start doing that? No, I didn't. And I didn't understand that concept. But if you have anybody in your audience that is pursuing or has the aspirations to pursue multifamily, then they need to start putting together pretty quickly a group of investors that may want to stand behind them with some type of equity support or some type of financial backing.
Yep, great point. It is a team sport, and it's almost more refreshing being in the multifamily world from what I found, because you're not out there as the Lone Ranger trying to do everything, which I've certainly done on a lot of houses, too many over the years, right? Where I was basically doing a lot of it, maybe not hanging the drywall, but it's kind of a solo effort, a lot of minutia and a lot to keep an eye on there. Whereas a bigger property, you might have 150 unit multifamily property, but you've got a property management company, you've got your legal team, you've got lots of folks on that team. And not only does that help spread the workload around, but it also has you have a lot of eyes on a big property. I mean, you're not just making a shoot from the hip decision to go take down a project. You've got a lot of experienced people looking at this project from a lot of different angles before you go take it down. What did your first larger multifamily project look like? Was it a really heavy value add, or what, was it pretty lightweight? Was it in your backyard, or were you flying out there? What did that look like?
Right. And so I was associated. So my start in the multifamily, like I mentioned before, began with single family investments. So I was pretty familiar with repairs. I was pretty familiar with the leasing process on a small scale, single family. Right. And so that's a pretty good break in to multifamily, but it doesn't qualify you to run a multifamily project. There's a lot of different aspects that are different enough that you do need professional assistance or you do need professional support. And so my very first project, well, let me kind of back up a little bit there. So I started and I thought, well, I'm just going to transition from single family to multifamily and I'm going to do the same thing. And for about 2 years or maybe 3 years, I tried that. And it was kind of like me saying that I was in a Mexican birthday party swinging at a piñata in the room. You know, you're blindfolded and you have this bat and try to hit it. I wasn't even in the right room. I wasn't even in the right house. I was spending so much effort in different ways that was unproductive and non-efficient that I should have gotten better advice sooner and partner with a coach or a team or somebody who had experience instead of just trying to do it myself. But finally, after about 2 years of just striking out again and again and again and spending so much effort, waste effort really, or just learning, I guess is a better way to say it, training and learning, I eventually found some right coaches and some right leaders and counselors and advisors. And then I was really able to take all of my efforts and all of my education, all the training, both from single family and then the processing of military systems and that, and then the 2 years of really kind of striking out. And so when I finally got on track, pointed in the right direction, it was a pretty quick acceleration. And my first project was a deep value add in my area in an emerging market that that we were able to accomplish. It was a 22 unit project. The purchase price was right around about $1 million, which was certainly a lot more than single family, but in the scale of multifamily, that's a pretty small project.
Sure.
And then it had about a $500,000 repair budget. And we just really, it was very fortunate timing. The market was evolving to a gentrifying area, and we got it at a good price and at a good point, and we were able to really, really capitalize on a lot of those different components.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great transition from the smaller property. So you're buying it $1 million, and then you're putting about half of that, or another $500,000, into the rehab. And if you look at kind of rough back of the napkin numbers, it's a pretty high ratio for a renovation. Who financed the thing for you? Was it tough to find somebody that wanted to lend the bank debt on it?
No, because the area was turning around. So we were kind of the very first people in this area. The area in Fort Worth was the western portion of downtown. And so there was a lot of momentum in this area. And we were one of the very first operators that came into a relatively older neighborhood. You know, most of the homes were in the 50s to 70s construction, 1970s construction. And so we were able to find a single family or a multifamily project. And most of the multifamily projects in this area were the same vintage. Mm-hmm. And we were one of the very first ones to come in and do a very high quality value add to it. And because of the demographics of that area, the rents really just took off. And for about the first week, we just sold it last this summer. And for the and we were just in the dominant position the entire time that we owned the project because we were the front runners and we had a really nice property. So the banks, after they saw what was happening in the area, they recognized what was happening with the development, right, and the merchants and that sort of thing. So it was not too difficult to do.
Yeah, that's great. Well, it sounds like you got a great project, and especially if it's local and kind of your first bigger project, that's really nice to have, right? You go check on it. Were you full-time investor at that time, or were you kind of, you know, going after your day job to go out there, or how did you balance all that? What did that look like?
Right. It was my side hustle. So again, to your audience out there, the great thing about real estate is it's passive income. And so you don't have to be engaged every single minute of each day. You can hire professionals to help assist with some of these tasks because the revenue is high enough in most cases that you can make that sort of side hustle. And that's what I did. It was pretty close to my work and to my house. So just within minutes. And so if I needed to respond or needed to be on site, I could do that without really much inconvenience, but I also had a trusted group of property managers, contractors, and other assistants that were that mentality of do it yourself versus hiring a team of professionals, I had to change, and so I'd already kind of broken through that mentality, and so I was able to do both. But for the most part, I was working a 50-hour full-time Air Force job while I was side hustling this, passive income stream.
Yeah, love it. Absolutely love hearing that story. You know, there's a lot of barriers to any worthy accomplishment, right? A lot of challenges. And you know, I talk to a lot of successful people on this podcast, and there's always that factor of, hey, listen, yeah, there's barriers, 50-hour job, learning curve, whatever, but you just go do it and you overcome. So I love hearing that. So after you got this property purchased and done some renovations, and sounds like you held it for a number of years, is that right? What was the total hold time on that one?
Just over 4 years is what we held it for.
Perfect. Perfect. So during that time, at what point after the acquisition of that property did you decide that it was time to pursue more multifamily projects?
Well, I always had the desire, and I always knew that at one point my Air Force service would be what I would retire from. And I just retired in June after 28 years of service.
Excellent. And so, congratulations.
Thank you. And so I knew that, you know, one project would not be sufficient to help me meet my financial goals and requirements. And so I was going to have to continue to scale. And so the first project, after we got that kind of going in the right direction, we started looking for other projects that were similar. Value add was my baseline strategy, maybe core plus strategy was kind of my strike zone in my area, because I live here in Fort Worth. And so I wanted to kind of stay where I could put my eyes on these types of work intensive projects. And sure. So I started looking pretty quickly to try to duplicate what I had done on the Heights apartments in Fort Worth. And I found a project about a year later that was very similar. And we did a very similar type of purchase, syndication. And we did the same thing with the value, our value component, to make repairs and improvements. And again, we just sold those two projects together. They were smaller projects, and we sold them as a portfolio here in the spring of this year, or the summer of this year, and they were really successful.
Yeah, outstanding. Just bundled them together. How big was that second property? So how big was the portfolio?
The portfolio was 40 units total. So we had a 23 and a 17, and they were very similar. And so one of the things to point out is when you have a smaller property or you're trying to work your way up into these bigger projects, you know, you hear different points of where the efficiencies begin to really capitalize. And so once you're working, you know, below maybe 50 or 60 units, once you breach over that, you kind of have a staffing. You have the revenue to have a little bit higher staff, and that's sometimes easier to do. So when we were working with these smaller projects, or if anybody in your audience has smaller projects or considering the purchase of a 30-unit, 45-unit project, sometimes it makes sense to maybe if you can couple those projects together to get a combined staff. And so these projects were small, and so I had a staff that did kind of the handling of both of them at the same time to improve the efficiencies.
Yep. That certainly helps stack up the unit count there and get that payroll or staff number bolstered a little bit, because it does help. Ironically, sometimes these properties that get larger can actually be easier because you've got a real payroll number, real staff, and so on and so forth. Well, that's excellent. So what did the process look like for you going forward? Were you continuing to kind of attract investor capital, work with brokers? Were you still actively pursuing the next multifamily project?
So from there, again, it's just a matter of making grandma's cake more than one time. So now you've got a recipe that you're familiar with, that you're comfortable with, you know, the different ingredients, what you're looking for. And now it's just a matter of duplicating that in the right marketplace. And so instead of just being a one-off investor where you hold one properties, now once you hold two or three properties, it's a matter of building a real estate investment business. Mm-hmm. And I just want to pause there for just 1 second. So I want to repeat that because it's very important. If you have people in your audience that are looking to go into multifamily, at some point, if they continue to scale, they're no longer multifamily investors. They have a multifamily investment business. And those two things, you think, well, there's a lot of similarities, and there certainly are, but just because you can own one property doesn't mean the differences to scale up to a multifamily investment business are different, because you have to talk about asset management. You have to be a, you have to have pretty much a staff that handles investment relationships, because those are the important things. And so now what I'm learning, this was 4 or 5 years ago, is you've got one property, you're the property manager, so to speak. You've got two properties. Now you manage two properties. But now when you get to that scale point where you've got three or more projects, now you're really thinking about managing a real estate investment business, right?
Right.
And so when I got to that point, it's slightly different. And again, outside this context of what we're talking about today, but as you begin to scale, you need to start thinking as a businessman instead of a property owner, right? And so now I just duplicated that two or three more times to several other assets and tried to grow and learn from experienced real estate businessmen or businesswomen, not real estate owners, right? So there's a very subtle, similar type of skill set, but in many ways, a different skill set and a different area of responsibility that, again, you have to be knowledgeable about to be successful.
Yep, that's such a great point. You're really transitioning to CEO of essentially what's a private equity firm, right? Happens to be real estate, but you're having to work through other people rather than do the work yourself, which is really an entirely different skill set, right? What are some of the things that helped you transition from kind of an owner operator to more that CEO role where you're really counting on other people to execute those discrete tasks versus just, hey, I know exactly how to do it. Move out of the way. Let me just do this myself. At some point you run out of hours in the day to handle it that way, right?
That's right.
What's helped you make that transition?
Well, and that's where a lot of people, they top out, because it's very important that you build a good, qualified, and successful team. And my advice to people is, and this is something that I had to learn a hard way, and sometimes we even learn it day to day, is when you work with professionals or when you work with amateurs, they cost you money. When you work with professionals, they make you money. And so as a owner-operator, single-family pedigree background, I was always worried about, what is the cost? Let me just go with the lowest provider for this repair or the lowest provider for property management. And you can sometimes get away with that. But remember, cheap advice is not free and free advice is not cheap. So you want to hire professionals and the very best you can afford. And so the answer to your question, Devin, is this, is to be successful in that mentality of CEO is you hire smart people so they can tell you what to do. You don't hire smart people and you tell them what to do. And as your roles change, you have to learn new roles. And in the same way, you have to surrender some of your previous roles and responsibilities. Because if you think you're going to be having 5 or 6 different assets, and then you're going to be narrowed and scoped down into property management, lease write-ups, lease renewals into every property, and you've got 100, units, you're going to be overwhelmed and nobody's going to be driving the ship at the captain at the helm, because there's that the captain's responsibility and the person that swabs the deck, it's totally two different things and you can't do everything.
Yeah, that's very, very well said. You want to put the right team around you, and there's just not enough hours in the day at some point to be accomplishing all of those things. So you've done the value add projects. Have you guys stayed primarily in the Fort Worth area, or have you branched out your firm to other locations over the years?
Well, we have. I really like North Texas, and certainly we look sure. all around North Texas. But here's another critical point that I want to mention is, just like it, we've kind of used this boat analogy. I'm actually in the Air Force, but I like this analogy is, let's say you start at destination A in a harbor and you want to go to destination B, whether that it's a long journey or not, it doesn't matter. You have your sights on that journey. And as a result of that, you have to constantly be shifting and making navigation changes throughout that journey, because of the currents, the winds, the sails, and all of those sorts of things. Now, why do I make that analogy? Is because of this. Is because you ask me, do I look in Fort Worth as my destination? And the answer is yes. But my true destination is financial freedom. I want to use the vehicle of real estate to reach my financial goals. And that is my destination. That is the harbor that I'm trying to get to through multifamily investing. So during that time, even though I like Fort Worth and I like North Texas, I may have to change slightly my marketplace because Fort Worth is no longer the best weather, winds, currents, and I can go over to this other area and get a better return. And that's exactly what's happened, especially in today's market conditions. These primary markets are becoming so competitive that it is very difficult to find a good property where you can reach your destination. Remember, my destination is financial freedom or passive income. So you have to sometimes be willing to change your course, change the direction, but I'm never changing my destination. I'm only changing and amending my sales, my wins, based on current wins, conditions, and environmentals. So that's a very long analogy, but I think it helps clarify people's understanding that just because you're a real estate investor who lives in North Texas or lives in whatever area you live in, it may be convenient for you to invest there, but that may be literally swimming up current. I'd rather swim down current or float down current than have to swim up current.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I like your analogy about the destination not being a certain zip code or maybe necessarily even an asset class, but the destination is financial freedom. I know you guys have branched out into some other projects. I think, is there a new construction project that you want to highlight there? Because I would love to hear more about that.
Absolutely, Devin. So this is really about 2 years ago when, as an investor, whether you are a single family property owner or multifamily, or you have an investment business, the most important thing the captain can do, which is what Lane Bean is, the CEO or whatever your investor group is you have to be constantly evaluating those conditions of market. Where is your market? What are the demands and supplies? What is the capital market like in that area? And it's your responsibility to make sure that is always observed and you're constantly making changes in your strategy. And so about 2 or 3 years ago, when the pricing in these major market areas just became very inflated, the typical strategy of core plus and value add, which was what I was focusing on, just wasn't making sense anymore. And so what I had to do was look, okay, what are we going to be aiming for? And I'm just saying this is 2018 timeframe. What is the 2019 strategy? And now that we're in 2019, I'm thinking, what is the 2020 strategy? What is the 2021 strategy? And is it going to be a fix and flip, a flip and hold, whatever these different ideas that you like to execute? And I found that my strategy of value add in major metropolitan areas was just not going to work because either one, you're never going to find a property or you're going to overpay the property. Sure. And so what did I look for? And this is a long answer to your question. I apologize for being long-winded, but I think it helps develop the mentality as an owner that you have to have. And so we looked around, and right around this time frame was where the ideas of opportunity zone investing was occurring. An opportunity zone is an ability for you to reinvest your capital gains in a tax-deferred or tax-decreased situation, a very tax advantaged transaction for real estate investors or really for any businessman. And so what we looked at was the state governor in each area was able to designate these zones from the census, the 2010 census tract, as opportunity zones. And if you invested in this area, then you got a tremendous tax break. And if you can couple that tax advantage with a high quality real estate project, boom shakalaka. I mean, you're reducing your taxes, you're saving taxes, and you've got a really good real estate investment. That's a winning success strategy, right? But that strategy doesn't really pair well for existing projects because you have to double the amount that you bought it for. So if you bought it for $1 million, you'd have to put essentially $2 million into it, which is difficult to do. So it kind of parallels with, or it fits better with, a development project. So what do we do? In 2018, we looked at this, we learned about it, we studied it, we went to conferences, and we set out to pioneer opportunity zone real estate development projects. And we currently have one down in Austin, Texas, or in the vicinity of Austin, Texas. It's a development project that's 300 units. Again, why am I doing this? And when your listeners think about this, they think, why would I want to do that? That's not my strike zone. And I agree with you. That's not my strike zone either that I started with. But just like that analogy that I just used, my strategy or my destination is not to buy an existing project. My destination is financial freedom. And I have to start with a very good and successful strategy. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I changed and I pivoted from buying existing projects, which we still do, mm-hmm. but I also included into my arsenal of tools, hey, I also need to develop property when it makes sense and when it is in the right marketplace. So we have a development project in a very good area, and it's also benefited by opportunity zone tax advantages.
Excellent. Excellent. One of the things that I find funny about the opportunity zones is, to your point, it's based on 2010 census data, and we're basically in 2020. So you've got stuff that's a decade old. A friend of mine's building a hotel in a market where the hotel is really in a very desirable area, but it's an opportunity zone because it's based on 2010 census data. A decade ago, it was not a desirable area. So kind of some interesting nuances there, but also, to your point, some tremendous tax advantages and maybe a relatively small window of opportunity to strike with the opportunity zones, right? It's something that's not going to be around forever. So that's great. So you've continued to fine-tune your strategy and approach in order to continue on that track to financial freedom, not necessarily a specific asset class. What does the conversation look like for your investors? Is it because, you know, you can't go too all in on one asset class or area. You've got to be flexible with the strategy. Have you had success kind of navigating that conversation with your investors and saying, hey, we're trying different approaches here based on what opportunities present themselves?
Absolutely, Devin. So I always talk to investors, and I talk to you, and I talk to these other people, and this is my strategy, okay? And this is my objective, and this is what I get really contentment out of, is I greet everybody with this greeting. I say, greetings, multimillionaires, millionaires, or future millionaires. My job is to help you become a better millionaire. Right. So no matter where you are on that spectrum of financial worth, my job is to help you get to the next level. And I think that the best way to do that, that's Devin. So you asked me a question of what has been my response from my investor group. And so I always start with this, as I say, hey, Devin, you want to invest with me? Tell me about your financial goals. And a lot of investors haven't really thought this through. And so their response is, I want to be rich. I want to make money. Well, of course, everybody wants to make money. But I need to know what Devin's goals are. When do you need income? What amount of income do you have now? And how much do you need in the future? And I try to tailor what you're telling me with your financial requirements or your financial goals into the best available project. Because not every project is the same, and not every project, you may have two different strategies. One would be income-based strategy, one would be a growth-based strategy, and these may be fantastic opportunities and home runs in both asset classes. However, if Devin is an income needed or income required financial requirements, a value-add strategy is not what I want to place you in. Or if you're a value add, in other words, what I mean by that is you don't necessarily need month-to-month income, but in 5 years from now, you would like to have some type of value add so you can send your kids to college, or you want to buy a car, but you don't need the income prior to that point. Well, an income-based strategy where you get a consistent monthly payment with really no tremendous upside, that wouldn't be a good fit for you, right? So to answer your question, Devin, is I try to listen to what the investor's responsibility and what their requirements are, and then marry that with the type of my knowledge of real estate strategy and what these potential assets could be, and say, well, it's probably not best fit for you right now, but we're looking in 6 months to acquire that type of project. You know, let's put a tap the brakes on your investment right now, or I'll offer another investor that sponsor that I know, and offer you him that. And so I really try to make sure, and I have a four funnel investor decision that I help people work through, and it's a sequential funnel. The top is wide, the narrow bottom is the fourth step, and you have to qualify at each step for you to go down the tunnel, right? Or go down the funnel. And so real quickly, this is what I tell people as I say, one, for you to help Devin or help Lane or help John Q investor make the right decision, it's four steps. The very first one is your strategy of this real estate project align with your financial goals, right? And I already talked a little bit about that income or growth. The second is the marketplace supportive of the strategy? If we're going to do a growth-based strategy, we're looking for future value. Does the market represent that? Are people moving into this area? Are there job creations in this area? Is the market good? Okay, that's decision point two. If that disqualifies, it doesn't matter what decision point three and four are. But let's say that qualifies. Now, decision point three, as the funnel narrows down, tell me about your team. Do you have a team in place that can execute this strategy in this area successfully? Tell me about their experience. Tell me about your experience with this type of a market and this type of strategy. And then the fourth one, okay, which is what everybody generally focuses on at the exclusion sometimes of the three previous, is the property. How many units is it? Does it have granite countertops? Has it got carports? Those types of details are very important, and they're very critical to the success of the property, but they are subsequent to the previous three decisions that need to be made. And so if you can't make those three previous decisions correctly, there's no benefit, and there's a waste of time to decide, well, that, you know, this property has 100 units and they're charging $900 per rent, and we think we can get it at $925. These sorts of details, you know, are the last things to look at. So bringing all this discussion back to what you asked me, as you said, what has been your investor response to the things you're pitching, like value add strategy or income or growth based? And then we talked about development ideas. What has been the investor's decision? I help them go through that funnel so that when they can finally start making the qualifications, should I invest with Lane on this property in this market, and is my strategy correct? You know, if they understand that pretty well, then I feel like I've given them the confidence to make the right decision for them, to help them become a better millionaire, or hopefully, in our, you know, some of your audience, better multi-millionaires is really our goal.
That's right. That's right. I love it. I love that funnel and that approach. I think that's spot on. Well, this has been great. Lane, thank you for sharing your story and a little bit of insight in your projects. If somebody's listening and they want to reach out to you and connect with your universe, what's a good way for them to do that?
Thank you. Well, they can find me on my website. It's pilot-legacy.com, or they can email me at my lane.bean@pilot.legacy. Or pilot-legacy.com. So let me spell that because I just messed it up. lane@pilot-legacy.com.
Outstanding. We'll link to the website in the show notes as well. But congratulations on your success. I love hearing a story starting from one little house to large multifamily projects and helping people become better millionaires along the way. Continued success to you, Lane. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Devin, for the opportunity.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to the DJE Podcast. For more information, please go to djetexas.com.